Well, good morning, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. Sitting next to me is Renee, and both of us have quite a bit of car experience. Renee doesn't have much grease underneath her fingernails, but I do.
I think we got that established last week. Neither do you.
Today I don't.
Andy thought you had just gotten a manicure. But yeah. Whatever.
First of all, you have to draw the line between me and a manicure.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past you, but
I haven't yet. Yeah, it's not likely that I'm going to go in there and have my fingernails done.
No, probably not.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. 5 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock, 602-508-0960, and I'm going to do Chris a favor because he called in, and I'm going to take his call, and then I'm going to tell you about the Honda who had a vibration fixed by turning on the headlights. So, Chris, you're up first. How is it I can help you?
Oh boy, this is a problem. My 17-year-old son was full of himself, and he thought he could just pick a car out without any help. So he went and bought this Ford Excursion, a 2000, and he remembers the guy saying to him this would pass emissions. Well, he's had it for 6 months now, or seven, and now the fuel pump, he had it switched. And now it doesn't run as well. It's got some engine vibration now that it's got better fuel pressure. But he went down to a couple of shops to find out what that engine vibration was, and they told him that it was straight piped, meaning it has no catalytic converter, and for the engine light to not come on, he's got a computer in there that self wipes, and they said it would take $7,000 to fix all that. It's also got a speech programmer, but neither of us know what that is. Anyway, what is a possible solution? Well, all we can think about is to get this thing running right with a correct computer, and then maybe use it up country where we're not in Maricopa County.
Well, there's a lot of things that you just put on my table, but let me kind of regurgitate some of this to you. When he bought it, it was fine for about 7 months, so it didn't have any check engine light, and it
It should have had a check engine light. It's just that they said the computer is a type of, it's an aftermarket computer that self wipes. So the engine light, when it comes on or is going to come on, the computer wipes it out.
Okay.
So it doesn't show on the dash.
Does the check engine light, has it ever shown on the dash since you bought it?
No.
Okay. When you turn the key on, does the check engine light come on for 3 seconds when you just turn the key on?
Oh, I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Well, that's the first thing we have to test.
Okay.
I can't explain this hypothesis about you have a computer that's aftermarket computer and that you have to put a $7,000 computer in it. That none of that makes sense.
That would be for everything, the catalytic converter and everything.
Okay. Well, I'm still kind of confused about that because I'd like to have that job for $7,000. I could pretty much double or triple my money right there.
You could put a new engine in
it. I can damn near put a new engine in it for $7,000.
Yeah.
Well, not a new one, but a good rebuilt, low mileage rebuilt one. Is he had it through emissions? Is that the whole issue? Or does it, this now new running rough is the issue?
Oh, no, the running rough was the new issue, and while they were at it, when they went to plug in their computer, they found out this wasn't a normal computer and that it was self-wiping, clearing the light, the check engine light.
Okay. Well, if they couldn't plug in to the assembly line data link or the, what they call the diagnostic link, if they couldn't plug into it, then they didn't know it was self-wiping. And that's a word that I've never used in 39 years, self-wiping.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, we've never had any of that. So it's a bad idea to try to fix your car based on what other people have said, because
I've heard you say that before. Boy, you're right. You know, you told us to take another car down to Bell Auto and just shut up and let them diagnose it.
Yeah.
And it worked out great.
Okay. Well, Craig is one of the best technicians that I know. I like him. His wife works there too. What's her name?
Vicky.
And Vicky actually plays the music, and Craig dances to the music, even though Craig is 9 feet tall. Vicky has the disposition of a very kind lady, but mm-hmm. she also has huge fangs.
She's strong.
She's a very strong woman. Here's the issue. We need to attack this one at a time. The first thing we need to do is get it to run. But what bothers me is we did a fuel pump. So somebody diagnosed something, then they put a fuel pump in it, and now you have this running poorly issue. So I think that it's entirely possible that the fuel pump wasn't the issue, and I think the problem manifested itself to this running poorly. So I think the focus should be, first and foremost, forget the check engine light, forget all this other cow manure. Let's just deal with running bad, and let's fix that. And then after that, if you've got a straight pipe on, and obviously the guy lied to you, because if you don't have a catalytic converter, this thing ain't going to pass emissions. It's more likely that they took the light bulb out of the dash in order to make the light not come on. It's more likely that's the circuit we have to go in and look at. Now, they would have, I don't know how they plug in and determine this self-wipe kind of thing, but I don't buy that at all. I've never heard that, nor have I used that. Here's what they're talking about, or here's what really goes on. When you have an engine computer on every car pretty much since probably 2000, you can't just fix something and expect the computer to bless the fix. There is a time frame that could very well be 3 days to a week or 10 days. The computer has to see repetitiousness. It has to see this problem. It sees it go rich and it sees it goes lean. It needs to see that. This is called the monitor. So there's a monitoring system in there. So here's what happens. People used to go to the emissions and they'd fail. So they'd fail because the check engine light's on. So they would reset the check engine light. They'd go over to one of the auto parts store and they'd reset the engine. Or they'd take the negative cable off and they'd put it back on. Now the check engine light's not going to come back on until it sees this problem numerous times. So they try to sneak into the emission station. But what they don't understand is there's a monitor that has to be reset. So when you disconnect the negative cable, I want to see X amount of times that everything's okay, which could be 3 days to 10 days. And so at the end of the time, I'm going to reset the monitor and say zero. And at that point, when you go to the emission station, they look at the monitor and they go, oh, Mark Salem, you just disconnected the cable because the monitor hasn't reset. So you need to come back after the monitor has reset, which is 3 to 10 days. So if the monitor's reset, then that shows that the fix I affected worked perfectly. So we've got all this going on. As far as the exhaust is concerned, if you're in Scottsdale, Scottsdale muffler is a derivative of Mesa muffler, and Mesa muffler's who I deal with. You can feel very comfortable to go to Scottsdale muffler at the appropriate time and get an estimate to finish out the exhaust system on your car. He knows how to do it. He's worked around exhaust all of his life. The two boys that own Mesa Muffler and Scottsdale Muffler have been around cars ever since I was a youngster. So these guys really know what they're talking about. But the first thing I do is I go to Craig and just show him and tell him that it's how it's running and have him, what's your diagnostic fee, and then call me with an estimate. I think that's step one. So good luck to you, Chris. Thank you very much. Speaking of good auto repair shops on the other end of town, mm-hmm. Action Auto is up on I-17 in Deer Valley. He's a full-service family-owned operation. I refer people to him in the Deer Valley and North Phoenix area, and he's been open since 1983. Tom and him, his technicians are good. They're good at what I call the five basics. They're good at writing down the symptoms. They're good at diagnosing the symptoms. They're good at bidding the symptoms, the repair, and keeping within their bid. And last, they're really good at verifying that the problem you brought it in for didn't leave. The car didn't leave with the same problem. So there's five steps that are really, really important with the respect of getting your car fixed and fixed right. So Action Auto is up there. If you don't have a repair shop, then perhaps maybe you should try them. And you don't have to go in there with a $1,000 repair. Go in there with an oil change. Mm-hmm. Call them up and say, I'd like to have an oil change, and see how you like them and see how they
Dan
talk
is your
you.
Next caller, Dan.
So those are the issues mm-hmm. that you actually have. Let's go to Dan. Dan, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Yeah, Mark?
Yes, sir.
Here's my concern. I got my oil change in my Tacoma truck, 2012, and then it only had 49,000 miles on it. And the shop I went to wanted to do a transmission change, you know, the change of fluid. They said it was dirty. And I said, don't worry, we're not going to do that because it's not called for at this time. and I knew I didn't have any symptoms or anything. And they're telling me, well, it's dirty. Isn't it a closed system? How are they going to see whether it's dirty or clean or whatever?
Okay. The answer is it can be dirty. What they should have done and what you can do is you take the dipstick out of the engine and put a drop of oil on the end of the dipstick on your chrome bumper. Then you pull the transmission dipstick and put a drop of oil, and it's going to be red, and you're going to put it right next to the oil. Then you're going to take the power steering cap off, and it's going to have oil on the dipstick of it, and you're going to tap that. You're going to be able to see, anybody can see dirty. So you're going to look at the oil and see how close to amber it is and what kind of light reflects from the chrome bumper through it. I promise you, you can tell oil that's one day old versus oil that's 3,000 miles old. However, at 3,000, it's still amber, and you can still see through it. So you go, okay, well, I see a change, but not a drastic. It's entirely possible on your Toyota that the power steering fluid and the transmission fluid are interchangeable, and it's entirely possible both of them are going to be red. So you're going to compare power steering fluid to the transmission fluid. Another thing you can do is you can pull the dipstick and touch your fingernail with it as well. You can see the light reflect through your fingernail. You should have said to them, in a respectful way, well, let's walk out into the shop, and I would like you to just put a dab of brand new transmission fluid on a white towel while I'm watching you. And then I want you to pull the dipstick, and I want you to tap the dipstick right next to it. Can you show me what you're seeing? Because I can assure you that if we pull the dipstick out and it looks like brown shoe polish, I'm going to have your butt back in the shop, and I'm going to show you the fluid that it calls for and the fluid I pulled out of the dipstick, and you're going to know the difference. I am impressed that you said it doesn't call for a transmission service this early. That is something that my industry bends some of the parameters because we're in Arizona. A. B, because the manual was written for everybody but Arizona. C, I have decided for myself that you need to have this serviced at 30 or 35 instead of 60 the way the book says. All these different reasons, but the book is still the manual, and believe it or not, the book was written for Death Valley, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Phoenix, Arizona. So the fact of the matter is that's what the book is. But I'm impressed that you knew that. I'm impressed that you said no. There's just one tweak to the action, and that's take me out in the shop and show me. And then if you hear, oh, no, I can't do that. I can't take you out in the shop. Customers aren't allowed in the shop. That should tell you all you need to know. That should tell you all you need to know about that shop. Because there's nothing in our insurance that says customers can't be in the shop, although they tell us they want the customer to be escorted in and out of the shop. Their big fear is he's going to walk through the shop, trip over something, fall down, and gash his head on the tool bench. Well, if you're walking with him, then you're going to say, step over this or do that. So they want, it's not written in concrete, but it's written in the rules of good businesses. Escort the customer in and out of the shop. 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open. You're welcome to join us. And when we come back, I'm going to explain the Honda that the headlights fixed the vibration. We'll be back. Everybody, 602-508-0960. John's on the phone. Stay right there, John. I got a little business to take care of, but we have four lines open. If you have a car question, a car problem, or a car comment, if you want to ask me my opinion about something you've been told, then I'm more than willing to share that with you. And just keep in mind, it's my opinion. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Kurtz Auto Repair. Kurtz is proud to be an independent, family-owned and operated auto repair facility. They recently were recognized as one of the best Better Business Bureau Ethics Award winner, and that says a whole lot about how they run their shop. They do gas and diesel. They do just about everything, and I tease people and tell them they can take their gasoline-powered blowers in there, and Kurt always laughs about that. But he's been in business since 1987. He has ASC-certified technicians as well as he's a master ASC-certified technician, and so is Jeff and so is Eric. Those are the three key people at Kurtz, and they're all master's techs. So Kurtz Auto Repair is I-17 and Bell Road in northeast corner of I-17 and Bell. Real quick, John, let me just finish this up. Here's the email. I have a 2016 Honda CR-V. We bought it new. It has 100 It has 18,000 miles. After 5,000 miles, we began to experience vibration problems. At a stop at a traffic light with the engine in drive, the whole car starts vibrating. The only way to stop the vibration is shift to neutral. Sometimes it doesn't work. Honda would at first not admit a problem, and then they switched. The car kept going in for this vibration, kept going in. So far, after four times in the shop, they've switched out two motor mounts and transmission mounts. It's still doing it. The small children in the back seat can feel it. Occasionally, the right turn camera on the mirror bounces so hard I can't even see it. So she's describing a perfect, ugly scenario of a complete car vibration.
Okay.
They came out, this is a 2016 Honda.
Mm-hmm.
They came out with a fix because what's going on is the idle is fluctuating and it's in an area it doesn't belong. That's creating the vibration.
Okay.
And it's a voltage problem. So they have a software patch for everything up to 2015 that fixes this problem. But not for a 16, which is what this lady has.
Okay.
So we know it's a voltage problem, so we watch the voltage. And we notice the voltage changes dramatically, and we're not used to seeing that. So in an effort to kind of, to tax the electrical system, mm-hmm. you have to turn on something. So we turned on the air, and lo and behold, the voltage stabilized.
Okay.
So it didn't do the vibration, idle vibration.
Right.
Turn off the air, it comes back.
Okay.
Well, we can't have the lady turn on the air conditioning in the wintertime.
When it's freezing outside.
So the next big draw, the electrical system draw that we could create is headlights.
Mm-hmm.
So we turn on the headlights and the problem goes away.
Oh, wow.
So she has automatic headlights. So she knows that she can just go to automatic and drive it with the headlights. And when you do that, the car is fixed. The vibration is gone. In spite of the fact they've done all the motor mounts and they
danced. That's what I was going to say.
But it wasn't on her dime, I don't think.
Oh, okay.
I think
well,
it was on their dime.
That's a good
So
thing.
The idea is when we turn on the electrical, it's kind of like a sprinkler system. When you turn on one head, that the water pressure is pretty good. When you turn on 10 heads, the water pressure has to come up in order to handle 10. So by turning on the headlights, we're creating a draw that's telling the alternator, hey, you better put out a little bit more. So we're asking the alternator to just raise the limit just a little bit, to raise the voltage.
Mm-hmm.
So in spite of the fact that there's no fix for this, then I talked to her the other day to verify that this is the fix, turning on the headlights, and she said, well, I could put it in auto, but what I prefer to do is just turn them on. And I said, well, I'm worried about you shutting the car off and forgetting to turn off the headlights. And she says, well, there is a really loud doorbell telling me that I forgot to turn the headlights off. So she says, I'm working it that way. And I said, perfect. That's perfect.
So it's been working. Well, that's good.
So the fix was turn on your headlights when you're driving the car. Sooner or later, Honda's going to decide to fix the 16s.
Does Honda know that yet?
But you can't do it. I can't put a 15 reflash on a 16 car. Just like you can't put a Windows XP reflash on your Windows 10.
It won't work.
They won't work.
Okay.
All right, John, good morning to you. How is it I can help you?
Yeah, I'm getting ready to store a car, and I've heard on your show to fill the gas tank, put that fuel stabilizer in. What I haven't heard is how long can I store that car without having a fuel problem?
Well, I can tell you firsthand that when I use Stabil and some of my equipment up at the ranch, I don't care if I store it for a year. Sometimes I'll have a chainsaw that I'll only use once a year, and I put Stabil in it. So if it's something that I don't use on a regular basis, I know that a year is okay for me. Now, that includes a gas tank on a chainsaw that might be 16, 20 ounces big, all the way up to some generators that I have that are ready to be used. And I've got that one big Bobcat generator, that giant one mm-hmm. that runs the whole barn and the whole house. And I probably fire that up once a year and run it for about 30 minutes on high idle.
Okay.
And I never have any problems with it. And it has, a 12-gallon tank, and I've treated that with Stabil. So the answer to your question is I'm very comfortable telling you you could store the car for a year with no problems at all.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Let me just add something to that. How long are you going to store your car?
Probably 6 months, maybe okay. 8.
All right. So let me make a couple of other. You're going to store it inside or outside?
Inside.
Okay. Are you concerned about the tires at all? Have you heard stories about tires and getting flat spots and all that kind of jazz?
No.
Okay, good. because I want to tell you that that's not going to happen. Some people want to insulate the tires from the hot asphalt, so they go down to Lowe's or Home Depot and have them cut four squares of quarter-inch plywood, and they park the car on top of the wood, which acts as an insulator. If you're going to store it for 6 months full of fuel with Stabil, but I would also suggest that you store it full of fresh oil. So I would have the oil changed just before you store it, and I'd put 10 miles or so on it to circulate the oil. The oil is going to have a lot of acids and byproducts that we really don't want to just settle in the bottom of the pan. So I think it's a good idea to have an oil change done a day or two or three before you're going to park it. And that and then during the oil change, have the tires aired up to the maximum inflation written on the side of the tire. And then all your fluids and hoses and belts checked. And
2 minutes.
The last question you're going to have is are you going to disconnect the battery or not?
Hadn't thought about it, but that's probably a good idea.
Well, to be honest with you, I would try it for 6 months because there's a good chance it'll just be fine in 6 months. If you disconnect it now, you're going to lose all your radio presets and all your seat presets, and it's going to lose a lot of parameters that it will take about 2 or 3 weeks to build back up. So I would suggest that you just leave it connected. That's the path of least resistance.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, and thank you for holding as long as you did. 602-508-0960. The lines are wide open if you have a car question. 602-508-0960. I've got an email that I've got. I can't really name the shops because I don't do that, but I'll read that on the other side of this break, and then we can talk about it. But there's an issue of head gaskets, and this shop said this, and I think this shop took advantage of me and stuff like that. So we'll just talk about the parameters, and I share this with you in an effort to help you understand some of the common sense approaches to shop A it's this, and shop B said it's this, and shop C said it's this. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you can tell me is what they each charged for their diagnosis, and that helps me because an armchair diagnosis is worth just exactly what you paid for it. But if a guy spent, you know, $75 or $100 of your money, and he said, this is the part I'm going to replace, and this is why I'm going to replace it, and the parameters are out of whack, and I expect to see three, and it's stuck at one, and so forth and so on, that's the information that you need. Then you look at him and say, I want to make sure we're not guessing with my money. I want to make sure that you're going to fix my problem with your estimate, right? You're going to fix my problem. That's a conversation you should have with everybody, and I tell my own customers you should do that at my shop as well. Make them stand firm on their diagnosis. Make sure they know you're going to hold their feet to the fire. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. Let me tell you about it real quick about a shop in Mesa that's on my best car repair shops list, and you can get that information from marksalem.com. So you can click on best car repair shops, and then you can pick mechanical and stuff like that. Anyway, Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing has been around in Mesa since 1970. They're the only shop that's been able to pass the list of demands, I guess, or levels of cooperation or quality. But they have passed, and no one in Mesa has. There's other good shops in Mesa, but they don't have the time I want in business. They don't have the certifications. They may not have insurance. Those are the reasons. But Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing on Main Street just east of Stapley has and will always have all of those. They have ASC certified technicians. They do friendly reminders letting you know when you might be due based on your mileage, what you might be due. So if you're in Mesa and you don't have a repair shop, might I suggest you stop by Thompson's or call them, schedule an oil change, and get to meet Brian and his wife Thelma. You'll find out what I already know, and these are the kind of people that you would hope would be somebody who actually would be your next-door neighbors or something like that, because that's the kind of people that Brian and Thelma are. Thompson's Auto Repair and Towing. We're going to go to the phones, and we're going to talk to Jerry. Jerry, you're up first. How can I help you?
Yes, good morning, Mark. Question I have, and this is to help my son out, because I think I'm right, but he says I'm not. This transmission oils now, you can't find just Dextron 3 anymore. Everything now is Dextron, Mercon, and does that still qualifies as a Dextron 3 product to put in a car that says required Dextron 3?
Okay, well, the Dextron and the Dextron Mercon are actually old transmission fluids. They're not really the newest. There is proprietary coolants now, as you probably know. There's seven different colors of coolant. And now we have what the The car makers say you must use, but really legally they can't tell you that. So then you have different oils, and you have different transmission oils. But the fact of the matter is there's universals out there now that are all qualified. So I'll give you a good example on coolant. We use amber coolant, which is a universal coolant. It can go in any car, in any diesel, in any application. And the company like Xerox that stands behind it, or Peak that stands behind it, those are billion-dollar companies, and they write it down. We'll protect you if, in case anybody says that our coolant caused the engine to fail. We'll protect you. So I would go with a universal coolant or a universal transmission fluid if I were you. I think Valvoline makes a universal, and I wish I could think of the name of that right now, but I can't. Another thing that you can do is you can Google transmission fluid, and you can put the make of your car in there, and then it will ask you some years and stuff like that, and then you can narrow it down to a couple of products. Last but not least, are you going to change all of it, or are you just going to do the four quarts and the filter?
No, we just redid the heads. We pulled out everything. So he's keeping the transmission fluid was changed not too long back. So he just wants to replace the amount that we pulled out.
Okay.
So
on the receipt that they did change it, did they happen to give you a clue as to what they put in there, or did they just put ATF?
Well, the last time, from what I remember, he said he put the standard Dextron 3.
Okay, and what kind of vehicle are we talking about?
This is a 94 Toyota 4Runner,
okay.
4x4.
If it calls Dextron, then you can put any Dextron you can find in there. So you can do a GM, okay. Or you can do a lot of them. They all say, they, really and truly, Dextron originally came out in the GM, and then Ford wanted their own. So that's where Mercon came from. And so, but in reality, now that the two of them don't really have a big determination, a big change, or they both want Ford fluid in this and Chevrolet in the other, there's lots of those fluids that are multi-purpose. And in your Toyota, it follows GM most of the time. So Dextron 3 would be an appropriate fluid to put back in your transmission.
Okay. Now, the other question I'd have, too, is this, they're saying they have Dextron 4, but it's a full synthetic. Do not want to blend both of those together, correct?
No, you can. That's what blended transmission and oil is. If you have a blend, it's half synthetic, or they won't tell you if it's half synthetic, but they say it's some synthetic and some conventional. So when you buy a transmission fluid that's called a semi-synthetic or a blended transmission fluid, you're getting some portion of this top end, which is synthetic, and some portion of the bottom end, which is conventional. So a mix of synthetic and conventional meets in the middle, and that's called a blend or a semi-synthetic. So you
can
put in whatever you want. In your case, I wouldn't put in the synthetic because it costs more money. So I would just use the Dex 3 if I were you.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for your help, because it's kind of confusing.
It is that. And thank you very much for asking. Thank you very much. What do you? Oh, Valvoline Max Life. Thank you for that. Thank you. She pulled your phone out. Valvoline Max Life is a fluid that you can use in your 94, and it's a universal fluid. I think the only thing that doesn't cover is some European cars that have a something based oil, some ester based oil or something like that. But Valvoline says that they cover us. They have a policy that covers us. So if we get sued, they're going to stand between us and who's suing us.
Okay.
So real quick, and I know we're up against a break, I need to go to John. John, how can I help you today?
Hey, Mark. I want to based on the guy that's going to be storing his car?
Yes, sir.
He was wanting to apply the stable into the fuel, right?
Yes, sir.
Does that bottle have all the instructions on using it?
Yes, sir. It actually comes with a little ounce where you tip the bottle and you fill up this reservoir that sits next to it. And so the directions will tell you this, this, or this. I want to tell you, I am a guy that follows directions most of the time. So when you have a lawnmower or a chainsaw, there's not going to be anything in there that says, you know, this, it's 10% of what you have, because you don't know what you have.
Right.
So if for my lawnmowers, I go, it's this kind of a glug. Okay, that's all I put. It might be a tablespoon or maybe two. That's all I put. And
well,
my generator, it holds, I think it holds 12 gallons, I think.
Okay.
And so I'm going to treat 12 gallons because I know it's 3/4 full. But there's no harmful effect of putting too much stable in your tank. It's not going to hurt your catalytic converter. It's not going to foul your spark plugs.
Okay. Right. I was thinking in terms of the actual things you do when you put it in the vehicle, because, like, you should put it in before you put the fuel in, and then drive the vehicle for a time to get it to circulate all through the fuel system, right?
No, not necessarily. What we're trying to do is prevent the gas from going bad in the tank. We're not trying to do anything forward of the fuel tank. We're just trying to keep the gas from turning sour in the tank.
So matter then on that?
No, it doesn't. To be honest with you, if you think about it, people are going to put Stabil, and then they're going to put the thing away. So they don't have to shake the car or anything like that at all, and they don't have to circulate it forward. If it was a freezing issue, then, yes, you'd take something in the tank and push it forward. But in this particular case, we're just keeping the gasoline from turning sour. So it's just put it in, and if you put it in, you lock the doors and you walk away, that's fine. That's okay. All righty? All right, thank you for bringing that up, John. Thank you very much. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. 45 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. This portion of Under the Hood is brought to you by Automatic Transmission Exchange. Folks, let me tell you, every single week in the city of Phoenix, an auto repair shop goes upside down. There, some of the parts vendors tell us that sometimes it's four a week. But I think, generally speaking, one guy goes out of business, and the parts vendors know who that is because he doesn't pay his bill. So for somebody to be in business since 1968, that is somebody who's in for the long haul.
Doing something right.
They're doing something right. Automatic Transmission Exchange is on 40th Street in Washington. It's on the north side of the road. If you go up and down Washington, you've passed it a million times. It's a great transmission shop. So if you're in Phoenix and you need somebody to drive your car, if you can demonstrate the problem, don't do it on Monday morning or Friday afternoon for obvious reasons, but they'll take a ride with you if you can duplicate the problem. That's the first step for successful and somewhat inexpensive transmission repair, is show them what it's doing. So Automatic Transmission Exchange, 40th Street in Washington, the north side of the road. David, you're up. How can I help you?
Must be a transmission day.
It's okay. It's okay.
Hey, I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Okay, I've had four or five Chevrolet or GM vehicle, GM trucks over the last 25, 30 years. I've been great. I have no issues with the engines at all. I get 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 miles before I sell them. But I've always had to change the transmission or rebuild the transmission after about 200,000 miles or 250. So my new truck now, what can I do to maybe make the transmission last longer?
Wow. You are the king of transmission life.
I know. I was going to say that's a long time.
What do you want? Holy mackerel. Wow. I'm not making fun of you. I am proud of you for popping 200,000 miles. I wish you would have turned your question around. Mark, I've owned GMs all my life. What would you tell me? What is the interval to change my transmission? When do I need to budget? My answer would have been between 100,000 and 150,000 miles. Mm-hmm. That would have been my answer.
Oh, no. 170 is about where I go. You know, about I can almost count on it, 170 to 200,000 miles.
Okay, think about this.
But I don't tow, you know, I don't tow a lot of stuff. I don't, you know, I do on occasion. I'm a contractor, so I'm towing little things here and there, but nothing big.
Well, you at 200,000 miles, that truck has been around the world 8 times on the equator. 25,000 miles completely around the world. Your truck has circled the world at the equator 8 times. And you want more? Listen, I'm teasing you, and thank you for laughing. Really, there is nothing you can do. Whatever you're doing, you got to keep doing that. I don't even get that life out of my transmissions. My wife doesn't get it out of hers. If she'd stop drag racing everybody off traffic lights, I'd probably get her a little higher. But no, whatever you're doing, however you're changing the fluid, however you're towing, when you pull it out of overdrive, when you're towing a trailer, whatever you're doing, you just keep doing it. And when you say your prayers at night, you tell them that Mark Salem thinks you are the king of transmission life.
Okay, I don't know. Okay.
All right. I don't know anybody else.
Can I ask a
Go ahead.
Can I do, like, is it better to service the transmission? I have bad luck when I change the transmission fluid.
Okay.
So I just leave it in now.
And you can do that. If that's what got you, you know, where you're at today, then go ahead. I'm not of the opinion for that. The old days when we put new transmission fluid in it, everybody said it broke loose all the dirt, and then the arteries of the transmission got clogged up and the transmission would fail. There was merit to that in the 70s. In the 70s, there was merit to that. Today, it's not. The issue is when do I change it? Well, if you're going to pull the pan, you're going to get 4 of the 12 to 16 quarts. If you do a flush, you're going to get all of them. Well, you got to do the pan every once in a while because that's where the filter's at, and we can't let the filter fill up with a bunch of metal. So here's what I do on my own truck. Every 100,000 miles, the first time, first service, I'm going to pull the pan, put 4 quarts in it, put a new filter. That's at 25,000 miles. Then at 100, I'm going to flush the whole thing. I might do it 75 to 100. I'm going to flush all the fluid. I'm going to leave the pan alone, leave the filter. Then the next one, I'm going to do the filter. Then the next one, I'm going to do a flush. So basically, at 25, I'm doing the filter, and probably 75, I'm doing a flush, and then at 25, I'm doing the filter, and then 75, I'm doing a flush. That's how I do mine. I haul a little bit heavier than you're talking about because I'm hauling farm equipment, tractors, bobcats, excavators, 4 horses, and then if my wife brings a bunch of her girlfriends, there's another couple tons I'm hauling around.
Oh, golly. You are in trouble now.
Oh, come on. So anyway, I think you've done fine.
All right.
Just stick with what you're doing. Thank you very much, David. Josh, you're up next. How can I help you?
Mr. Salem, Andy, how you doing? Old friend here.
Oh, okay.
From behind the building, the landscape company.
Okay.
Oh, Josh, the sprinkler guru.
Yes,
and I understand you were on a boat with my son, you two guys as family, and that you would disappear at one time or another where your wife and your dad didn't know where the two of you went. Was that the truth?
I can't. You know what happens on the ocean. Right.
Good work, Josh. Good work. All right, what can I do for you, buddy?
Hey, so this morning, my wife and I have a 2012 Buick Enclave, and this morning she went to work out, and on her way home from working out, she stopped at a store, and when she got back in the car, it started real, real hard, and then she said the Stabilitrack service, the traction control is off, service it, and then she pulled over and stopped to call me, and then smoke started coming out of the right exhaust pipe. She said the last 2 or 3 mornings, it has started hard. That's about all the info I have. Any thoughts, or should I drive this thing or have it towed?
Well, forget the Stabilitrack and the traction control. That's going to be a separate issue. The smoke out of the tailpipe, we need to know what color. Black, white, blue, gray. So we need to know that. The starting hard and rough is probably going to leave some trace in the computer. So we can go in and look at some fuel trim numbers and see if it's running rich or running lean. But let's divide a line right down the middle and let's stick with the heart. It cranks over, but it doesn't catch, I think is what she means. It goes rub da 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 da, and it does that a lot before it catches, where before it's kind of a and it starts right up. How many miles are on
exactly?
It? Okay, how many miles?
Only 68,000.
Okay. This can be really anything, but forget the Stabilitrack and all that kind of stuff. We don't want to deal with that right now because all those lights are telling you is I've disabled the Stabilitrack and the ABS or whatever else it had because I saw a problem. We'll deal with that later. That's not going to put anybody in harm's way. Let's fix the problem of it running poorly. So if it doesn't start and run, yeah, you're going to have it towed. But if you can limp it in, the only thing I don't want to see is smoke anywhere but the tailpipe. That's all. If it smokes underneath the hood, Josh, you got to pull it over. And don't open the hood.
Exactly.
Okay? So, and tell her that anything that's wrong with this, if she's the primary driver, it's her fault.
Yeah, I don't know if that's been going very well.
See,
I
want to
do more of those boat vacations.
I understand. Well, Josh, thank you very much, and if we can help you, we will help you, and Alan would be your contact.
Well, if I can get it that far, I will.
Okay.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Rick, how are you today? What can we do for you?
I'm very well, Mark. Thank you very much. Hey, I'm having brake problems with a 2011 Chevrolet Corvette, It's the Grand Sport model. Okay. It has the Z06 suspension, so it has the six piston calipers on the front end, and the squealing is primarily coming from the front end. My dilemma is, let me back up just a little bit. The car has almost 21,000 miles on it. I bought it with 14,500 miles on it. I put 6,000 miles on it in the last couple of years.
Okay.
Go ahead. I notice a squealing at very, very low speeds, like if I'm on a parking lot at the grocery store or something, that's when I'll notice the squealing coming from the front end.
Okay.
So I went to a local shop recently, and they came back and said, hey, you've got to have new pads and new rotors at 20,500 miles. And I asked about machining the rotors or resurfacing them, and they said those are cross-drilled. They cannot be resurfaced or machined. They have to be replaced. Where I get into a jam on it, I'm frustrated, is they quoted me $480 a piece for those rotors, and I go home and I look online at GMPartsDirect.com, and they're $90. I look at another website for OEM parts or genuine GM parts, and they're $75.
Okay, hold on. You're putting too many things on my plate. Okay, let's go back to the real problem, and I'll deal with both of them at the same time, or one right after the other. The brakes are.
Yes, sir.
I'm real familiar with the Z06 Camaro or Corvette. I have one. I'm real familiar with those. The problem is you got 21,000 miles, and mine is a 2006, and mine has 21,000 miles. So I'm even older than you are. This car has never really been driven like it's designed. The brakes are squealing because the pads are vibrating like a guitar string. They're vibrating. If you push a little bit harder, the squeal goes away. When you apply the brakes gently, then we use the front brakes. They're usually 60% of the braking, and the back are 40% of the braking. The nose dives, the front brakes work. It's not going to be calipers, because if there's a caliper problem, you have uneven wear front inner and outer pad. You haven't said a word about that, neither did they. They want to hang pads and rotors on it. That's not going to fix it. If you want to stop it, you bevel the pads so the pads no longer can vibrate, or you put a new hardware kit on each of the fronts, which the hardware kit can't be $30, $40, $50. And so you put a hardware kit, and it comes with shims and some springs to keep the pads from vibrating. But there's no harm. There's no foul. It's the aggravation. That's all it is. This is not going to put your life in jeopardy, because in a Corvette, you're going to hammer the brakes when you're drag racing a Mustang and he's in your rearview mirror and you see a police car, you're going to hammer the brakes. So this is not a problem. As far as parts pricing is concerned, it's not fair to you or the shop unless you're comparing part numbers. Because let me tell you, there is no such thing as a General Motors rotor. There is no such thing. The lowest bidder in China or Mexico or Korea, they're the ones that build the rotor. I can tell you on a Ford, the alternator's Hitachi. The mass airflow sensor is Nippon Denso. The brakes are Bendix. The belts are a Goodyear Continental. And I could go on. And the fuel pump on a Ford today is made by Delphi, which is a derivative of Delco, which is a General Motors company.
Oh, my goodness.
So your car is made up from a lot. I want to tell you, if you want to fix this in a kind of a violent way, I want you to not coast to a stop. I want you to use the brakes the last 15 feet. Let's just hammer them just a little bit. But I would say to you, a hardware kit installed, and maybe do a little bit of crosshatch with a grinding wheel and spin the rotor around and just put a crosshatch on it so it's not like a record player. Then I would do that. I'd do inside of the rotor, the outside of the rotor, and I'd be done. So I got to take a break. I'll have more comments on the other side, and the lines are open, 602-508-0960. I'm going to calm down, and then I'm going to finish talking about the brake pricing or the parts pricing. We'll be back right after this.
Now, once again, here's Mark.
Well, welcome back, everybody. 4 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. We're here for another hour. I've got a lot on my plate, so I need to move through it pretty quick, and I'm going to do my best to do that. S&S Tire and Auto Service, they have three locations on the west side, and they are part of the best car repair shops list that I own and that I have maintained since 1988. They have three locations, Peoria, Surprise, and Goodyear. They offer a comprehensive line of tires, many different brands, for your car. And the reason why that's a good idea is because you can go to S&S, they'll look at your tire size, and they'll give you good, better, best pricing. So if you're going to turn it in for a lease, you might want to just put the lowest end on it or the middle end on it. But if you're going to keep it forever, you might want to be the top end, but they're going to give you that. They've got tires from wheelbarrows to tractors and everything in between. They can balance your tires. They do alignments and suspension work because when they get to see the old tires, they can read the tread wear, and then you know what's going on. So is it an alignment issue? Is it a balance issue? Is it a suspension issue? So S&S Tire West Side, Peoria, Surprise, or Goodyear, great place to go. I got to talk real quick about the issues with respect to parts. I'm going to tell you some secrets that you're not allowed to tell anybody else. When I buy Chevrolet parts, depending on where it comes from, I'm going to get a 25 to 30% discount. That doesn't extrapolate to a profit in any way, shape, or form. I'll get a 25% discount if he has to go get it from another dealership. I'll get 30% discount if he has it. Okay, so on a $100 part, I'll pay $70 for it. The description that you have is $400 versus $80 or $90. There's a problem there. We're not bidding apples to apples because I don't pay $90 for that rotor. If it's truly a $400 rotor, if I get 30% off that, I'm paying $120 less than the $400. In addition to that, if there's a difference in the parts in every way, shape, or form, other than quality, brand, and part number. Let me explain. If you bring your part to me and I install it in your car, then there is no warranty in any way, shape, or form. 3 weeks, 3 months later, the part fails. You bring it back. You have to pay the labor to take it off. I hand it to you. You mail it away. We wait 3 days until your part comes back. Then you have to pay the labor to reinstall it. And you have to pay shop supplies and environmental charges for that whole process. So it's not the same part. If it's my part, I cover the labor, I cover the sales tax, I cover the shop supplies and environmental charges, and you're in and out in 1 day instead of being in and out in 3 or 4 days. So it's not the same part. It doesn't have a warranty. And then here's the ugly part. In my world, if you bring, let's say you bring a mass airflow sensor and you hire me to put it on, and then it doesn't fix the problem that you had diagnosed on YouTube over the internet, I then have to prove to you that my installation wasn't defective. I have to defend my position for free. So I have to go in and diagnose the problem and show you I can fix it. I might have to put on my mass airflow sensor, or it's not even the mass airflow sensor, it's an air leak in the air tubing between the between your throttle body and your air filter. So I am obligated to prove to you that my work wasn't defective on installing your part, and that's going to cost me money. And if your part's bad, I have to prove that, and that's my money. And then if there's an accusation that I did something wrong, I have to prove myself. So you can see that there's a big difference. There is a world of difference between a $90 part on the internet and a $400 list price, even if the shop doubled their cost. If the shop said, I want to double the $200 rotor and charge you $400, there's a problem there. Even then, he paid $200. Even if you think he's going to double his money, he paid $200 for a $400 rotor, and you're paying $90. There's a problem there. It is true that I can Google part numbers I install on your car and can find them cheaper, typically 10 to 15% cheaper, but that's still a 2 to 3 day out of commission time. Your car's going to sit here. Plus, it's days that I don't have to because I can access the part here locally. So that's kind of the part issue. Few people buy at the Brian bracket I do just because of the sheer volume of parts that my shop sells. So when I talk about discounts, there's guys out there that are in the 10 and 15% when I'm in the 25 to 35% because they spend $200 a month and I spend $5,000 a month at a particular place. I think we spend in the vicinity of $50,000 to $60,000, maybe $70,000 a month in parts. And I'm extrapolating that to half of the labor, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, so whatever our gross is for the... So if we have a $200,000 a month, these are just stupid numbers. It's easy for me to do the math. $200,000 part or $200,000 a month, it's basically half parts and half labor. So if it's half parts at $100,000, then that means that we're going to spend for those parts $60,000 or $70,000 for those parts.
Right.
So that's kind of how it works, and so that addresses Rick's issue with respect to parts. I still think that in Rick's particular issue, he just needs to drive it a little bit more violently. I think if he just stops
a little bit more violently.
Yes.
Okay.
Stops a little bit. I mean, just don't coast into a stop.
Right.
Just wait till the last 10 feet and try not to hit the guy in front of you. Okay, Art, thank you for holding as long as you have. Art, how can I help you?
Hi, Mark. I have a 96 Cutlass Sierra that has a T304 trouble code misfire in cylinder number 4 that I've been trying to diagnose.
Okay. Well, let's. I don't need you to tell me what you've done because all the things that you've done haven't fixed it. And so to rehash that is just a way. I don't want to use your diagnosis. Let me just tell you. I know for sure that you didn't swap 3 and 4 spark plugs, and if you would have done that, if it would have been a spark plug problem, it would have moved to the other cylinder, and that would have told you. You could switch coils, or you could switch spark plug wires, depending on whether you got coil over ignition or whether you got a distributor. And you said it was a 90s model, so it's probably got a distributor. The idea is that we're going to switch coils. So if we're going to switch a coil out of 4, then we're going to switch it with 6, and we're going to put 6 onto 4. We're going to see if it moves. We're also going to look at the cylinder contribution, something that you can't do because you don't have a $10,000 piece of equipment. So we're going to go in and we're going to have the computer kill each cylinder, and as we kill each cylinder, we lose 100 RPM drop. When we kill that cylinder, we only lose 10. We have a compression problem in that cylinder. We've got a valve that's stuck open. We've got something wrong in the cylinder. That's a mechanical issue that all the spark plugs in the world aren't going to fix. In addition to that, that particular number 4 cylinder may be sitting adjacent to the EGR valve, and maybe the EGR valve isn't closed all the way. That creates a vacuum leak. The vacuum leak causes a cylinder contribution problem because that cylinder is getting too much air and not enough fuel, so it's not participating as it should. Then we look at fuel trim, and the fuel trim all of a sudden has gone crazy to the lean side, which means we don't have enough fuel. Then we look and we find out that the fuel filter is plug solid, but that would pretty much cover a lot more than just one cylinder. But on that runner on your intake that feeds number 4 cylinder, there can be vacuum ports on that, and the other end of that hose can become disconnected, which causes that cylinder to run lean. The computer's simply telling you that there's something wrong with cylinder 4, I think. It could be a vacuum lead that services 4 and 5, and it's actually affecting both of them. But if it's a vacuum leak, which we find many times it is, the spark plugs and the wires and all that stuff isn't going to help it. So you need professional help for your car. For your car. And I think that the diagnostic on an 04 code for cylinder number 4 in your car, especially if it's a 90s model, I think the diagnostic code is going to be somewhere between as low as $50 all the way up to $85 or $100. But that's what you're going to have to do, because guessing is just a huge waste of money. I know that. I don't know how much you've spent. Can you tell me how much you've spent so far?
I've spent nothing so far. I've done everything that you just talked about. I swapped plug wires. I did not swap plugs. I swapped coil packs, and everything just stays at 4. It never travels with whatever I've swapped.
And each time you do that, you clear the code?
I clear the code, and a couple hours later, boom, it pops back up.
Okay. Well, I want to tell you, my life is full of these kinds of stories, as you can well imagine, because I've been on the radio for, 20, 30 years. And when people tell me they've done everything I said, I'm just giving you examples of what's going on. There's all kinds of other problems. You haven't swapped injectors. I don't know if you have an injector for each cylinder or if you have a throttle body, but the throttle body...
No, a year ago I had a plugged injector, and so I changed out all six of them.
Okay. Well, this conversation kind of starts and ends in the same way. I say this, you say I checked it. I say do this, you say I've done it. And so when we do that, we don't ever make any progress. I can't diagnose your car looking at it through your eyes. That ain't never going to happen. I diagnose off symptoms. So I can't help you. All I can tell you is I think you would probably be better served by having somebody else diagnose it that has the necessary equipment to do it. So good luck to you, Art. God bless you, buddy. Greg, you're up next. How can I help you, Greg? Greg?
You there?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Are you there? Oh, okay. Need to access your gray haired wisdom bank, sir. Have a 96 in credit, and it's been sitting for about 6 years.
Okay, hold on just a minute. Hold on. Are you on Bluetooth or something?
No, sir.
Okay.
I have a bad connection.
Okay, you're breaking up, and I just didn't know if you were talking to me through a speaker or something. Go ahead.
No. I have a 96 Intrepid, and it's been sitting for about 6 years. And I went to start it up, and of course the fuel pump is bad, so we put a fuel pump in. And we did get it fired up, but I have fuel, raw fuel, pouring out of it. So I'm not talking about a little, I'm talking about a lot. I thought it may have been fuel pressure regulated, so I disconnected the vacuum hose at the manifold.
1 minute.
And I did have a small amount of fuel coming back from out of the manifold through the vacuum port, but nothing coming out of the vacuum line that controlled the pressure regulator. Have you heard of this before?
Well, I don't think you tested it appropriately.
Probably not.
Okay, did you pull the vacuum line off of the fuel pressure regulator?
Yes, I pulled the vacuum line where it goes into the intake.
No.
Which goes directly from the...
No. Did you pull the vacuum line directly off the fuel pressure regulator?
No, I did not. I pulled the other end of the vacuum.
Okay, well, there's... Did you find gasoline on the other end? You said you saw that it was pouring out. Describe that. What you saw, it's something about gas pouring out or something. Not the tailpipe, but you said something else.
Yeah, when I pulled the other end of the vacuum line for the fuel pressure regulator working into the intake,
okay,
there was a small amount of fuel that poured back out of the intake.
Okay,
well, it didn't come out of the vacuum line.
All right. Well, so, it's the fuel pressure regulator.
Okay, well, then we'll put a fuel pressure regulator in it.
Well, I'm working off your eyes now. The vacuum line is for vacuum. There should be no fuel anywhere near the vacuum. On one side of the diaphragm in the fuel pressure regulator is vacuum. On the other side is fuel. So depending on whether there's an abundance of vacuum or the lack of vacuum, that diaphragm opens and closes the orifice for the return. So the fuel pressure regulator is at the end of the loop. And so when it closes the gate, we build fuel pressure to the injectors. When the gate opens up, we lose fuel pressure to the injectors. So this is happening all the time. The diaphragm on your fuel pressure regulator is bad, and it's allowing it to suck raw fuel from that circuit directly into your intake, and that's the reason why you got fuel coming out of your tailpipe. You can take this diagnosis to the bank that you have a bad fuel pressure regulator, and here's my caveat. Based on what you're telling me, then you better replace that fuel pressure regulator, and that will take care of your problem. All right, got to take a break. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Lines are wide open, and we'll take your call.
Raised up from
welcome under back, everybody. We're going to go straight to the callers. Oh, I got to tell you real quick about Larry Harkers. I'll tell you why Larry Harkers is a great guy to have on my list is because Bob there is a diagnostician extraordinaire. I have sent cars to him because of geographical issues, because the customer lived closer to 38th Avenue and Indian School than they did to South Tempe. So I've sent people to him, and every single time he's pulled the rabbit out of his proverbial hat. And I know that because I usually follow up with the customer, or the customer inevitably, if they're happy, they get back with me to tell me they're happy. So they've been around since 1967. Ellen, Bob's wife, runs the front, and Bob runs the shop. They do auto electrical work, brake service, auto emissions, vehicle maintenance, all the normal stuff. But if every time you turn on the turn signals, the windshield wipers flap and nobody else can fix it, Bob can at Larry Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School. Let's go to Jerry. Jerry, thank you for holding as long as you did. How can I help you?
Mark, I have a 2005 Grand Cherokee Limited with a 5.7 Hemi motor in it that I just bought and drove 100 miles prior to taking it up to Lake Tahoe this past Wednesday, where the engine light came on, and I believe it's regarding the transmission where it will not let it go into overdrive. Now, I had to drive 750 miles to the light on because I couldn't find any issues with the transmission fluid or any smell in the transmission, and it drove fine, but instead of being in D, it was in 3 on the transmission level for here.
Okay.
Now, is that an issue?
Well, if the fluid's not burnt, then no, you dodged a bullet. The question here is it's real simple. Did we go into overdrive, yes or no? And did the computer see that we went into overdrive, yes or no? And as you can imagine, we can go into overdrive, but the computer doesn't see it. So,
well, I saw it in the tachometer. So when I was driving 70 miles an hour, I was running about 21 to 2,000 RPM. When I stopped and did my investigation and then, you know, turned the motor off, turned everything back on, and then got back on the road when I thought everything was safe, it would never go past transmission level 3, and the RPMs ran higher, which was around 3,000.
Okay. All right.
At 70 miles an hour.
It still doesn't answer the question, did it go into gear and the computer didn't see it, or did it stay there and the computer is seeing it or is not seeing it? That's what has to happen first. If I can't explain the tachometer because I don't know what kind of a load you were at. And the Prindle, you're talking about the Prindle. The Prindle is the little window that says park, reverse, neutral, drive 1, drive 2, drive 3. That's just the name in the 1970s that stuck with that little window is called the Prindle window. It tells us what gear you're in. If you lost the overdrive, the ability for overdrive, if your brake light switch is stuck on, it will cancel overdrive. There's lots of ancillary and parameter issues that may or may not call the transmission to either apply or don't apply. It also could be some kind of a bad connection where it's trying to apply the overdrive, but it can't. What part of town do you live in?
Well, I live in Peoria, but I have a job in Lake Tahoe that I took the vehicle up this past Wednesday on, left it there, and then flew home.
Okay.
And because I drove in the blizzard on Thursday, I left it at the airport, flew home yesterday.
Okay.
But the transmission never gets hot, the fluid's fine. It just never goes into overdrive.
Okay. But
so
what you're telling me is kind of different than what I'm used to. If I'm running north of 3,000 RPM and I'm doing 70 miles an hour and I'm not in overdrive, I'm going to overheat the fluid. It's not really designed to run at sustained speeds at 3,000 RPM, or at least I would assume that I would have some smell to the fluid. I am concerned, and I think that you have an RPM problem, which would suggest that you have a gear problem. I understand that. Your tachometer tells me everything. That's a wonderful symptom that you've given me. But I can't fix your car over the phone. I can tell you that I'd make sure the brake light switch isn't stuck on, but if it was stuck on, it would have been dead after you let it sit for a day. So if you get back and it's dead, then yeah, maybe the brake lights have stuck on. I can't explain why you cycled the key, and after you cycled the key, we went from whatever you said, 16A or 1700 RPM up to 3,000 or just close to 3,000. I can't explain that. I don't think it's necessary to explain it because I can explain it after the truck is fixed, after your Jeep is fixed. So fix it first, and then we can explain why you had some of these symptoms. The only thing I can tell you is you need to find a good transmission shop in Las Vegas and have them look at it. Or Lake Tahoe, I'm sorry, in Lake Tahoe, and have them look at it. And how I would do that is I would call a couple of parts stores, and I would say to them, I'm from out of town, and I'm looking for somebody to help me diagnose an overdrive problem or apparent overdrive problem in my Jeep, Hemi motor Jeep. Who do you trust to work on your cars? And you might even ask for, like, the general manager of the parts store, who is the guy that you would trust? And he's usually going to tell you the guy who returns the parts the least. There's shops out there that order a part and return it, order a part and return it, and they're just swapping parts to try to fix it. The guys that really diagnose cars, they don't do that. You can also look on the website of the Automatic Transmission Rebuilders Association, ATRA, and they're going to have a shop in Lake Tahoe that will help you. And those guys are typically the top end of our industry. They're in the top 80%, or the top 20% of the 80%. But thank you, Jerry. Good luck to you, buddy. Gina, you're up next. How can I help you, Gina?
Hi, Mark. Love the show.
Thank
you. Okay. I got one problem fixed. Now I got another problem.
Okay.
A month after my tune-up was fine and 2 weeks after my oil change, now it's like click, click, nothing, click, click, start. Now I don't even think I get a click. I was able to start it. My alternator is, all the zones, the alternator is good, star is good, battery is good.
Okay.
But it's like nothing.
Okay. All right, well.
So I did get started, but it takes a while.
Okay.
No.
It's not possible that somebody's going to tell you that the alternator's good, the battery's good, and the starter's good. Because this is a low voltage situation. The click is a low voltage situation. So battery and alternator and starter all have to do with that. It's a foolish idea to tell everybody to fix your car, but the starter and the alternator and the battery are all okay, because one of them isn't. Now, here's what's important. You need to turn the headlights on every time you start the car and park in an area where you can see the reflection of a headlight against a wall or against the front of your garage or your garage door. Turn on your headlight. Just go to marksalem.com and print out FAQ 28. FAQ 28 describes you watching the headlights, and what the headlights do will help us diagnose your problem. But if I had to guess, I would say that I'm going to be 75% of the time right. It's going to be the solenoid that sits on the starter. And if that's the case, depending on the mileage of your car, I wouldn't want to go in and just do the solenoid. I would want to do the starter and solenoid together. And so if you want a wild guess from Mark Salem, the fact that it hasn't died and you haven't had to jump start it tells me it's not the alternator. It could very well be the battery, because the starter needs 9.5 volts in order to start the crank over and turn the motor over. And so if you get 8, all you're going to get is a click, because 8 volts will activate the solenoid, but 8 volts won't spin the starter motor. So we have two things going on there. The solenoid says, okay, starter, here's electricity, you turn the car over. But if the solenoid has electricity enough to talk, and it tells the starter to move, and the starter says, no, you're only giving me 8 volts, and I need 9.5. So you really need to be involved in this. But if you go to marksalem.com and click FAQ 28, I think that procedure, if you can follow that, and all it is watching the intensity of the headlights. Are the headlights white and bright? Are they yellow? And when it clicks, do the lights completely go out? That's what it's all about, FAQ 28. We'll be back talking about cars right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 33 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. We have two callers online, but we have three open lines available. Strictly Diesel and Service and Repair is a Better Business Bureau, A-plus rated shop. They work on diesels, light duty, light truck, foreign and domestic. So if you have a diesel, foreign or domestic, light truck or car, they work on diesels. They're on I-17 and Pinnacle Peak Road. Strictly Diesel Service and Repair is open Monday through Friday, and they sell parts 24 hours a day at their website. So you can get more information from my best car repair shops list under the diesel setting, but you can also just go to Strictly Diesel's website and see what kind of parts that they have. So if you're looking to dress your diesel up, make it a little faster or whatever, they've got those kinds of things on their website. That's Strictly Diesel. All right, we're going to go to the phones. Hector, thank you for holding. How can I help you?
Yes, sir. I have a 2000 Honda CR-V and also a 2000 Nissan Sentra. I'm trying to figure out which one to hold on to. I was wondering, would I be able to take it down to your shop so they can do a testing, or tell me which one would be my best interest to hold on to?
Well, let me ask you a couple questions. How many miles has a Honda got on it?
276,000.
Okay, and how many miles has the Sentra got on it?
That's a good question. I'm thinking 150. It's not even, that's not nearly as much as the Honda CR-V.
Okay. No, I can't tell you. I can't answer your question which one to keep, but I want to think out loud in front of you, okay? I would wonder how the maintenance bills, not normal maintenance, which is brakes and tire rotations and oil changes, forget that. This is above and beyond maintenance. This is diagnosis and repair of problem. Which one of these two vehicles has been better. That's something that you can, you know, answer to yourself. They're both 18 years old. I want to tell you that the 276,000 miles bothers me because it is my opinion that most engines have a life expectancy of about 300,000 miles to 400. I can also tell you that virtually every engine I have ever replaced has been damaged by the nut behind the wheel. So sometimes women overheat the car. Sometimes the guys think that they can make it another mile with the oil light on. But almost every engine I've replaced has been damaged by the driver. So if you avoid the overheat and you avoid the running them low on oil, then that engine will last a long time. Let me tell you that the end of both of those engines is when they start leaking oil because of internal pressure, and you start consuming oil because of internal pressure leaking as well as rings going bad. So when you foul a spark plug and it's oil fouled, that's, you're close to the end of that engine's life, and there's a good chance you've not had either one of those things happen on either one of these cars. So just based on the mileage alone, I would probably hang on to the Sentra because it's half the age of your CRV. Is your CRV have the automatic transmission, the single speed automatic transmission? I'm just missing the word right now. Okay. So it has a CVT transmission, a constant velocity transmission. That would be another reason I'd hang on to the Nissan. Both of their transmissions are expensive, but the Nissan typically can be rebuilt by a lot of guys in town where the CVT transmission, nobody wants to do anything except take one out of a crate off of a pallet and put it in your car. So of those two there, because of the reasons I've told you, I would hang on to the Sentra. Now, the second question real quick is which one does your wife want to hang on to?
Well, I bought her a Pilot, so she's good with that.
Oh.
She just wants me to hold on to one of these other ones.
Okay, and who's going to drive this car we're talking about? Is that going to be you?
Yes, that's okay. It, because I'm the only one that could
repair
it if I get down on the side of the road.
Fair enough. And how far do you drive to work and back? How many miles a year do you put on it?
30 miles a day at the most.
Okay, 150 times 50. So you're 7,500, 8,000, 9,000 miles a year approximately? Okay.
Sounds about right.
All right. Well, even if you do 8,000 miles a year, you're 130,000 miles away. So eight into that, you're 15.
Wait, what did you say?
I'm trying to figure out at 8,000 miles, how many months is it going to be before he gets from 150 to 276?
How many years?
Years.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of years.
You've got a lot of years left on the Sentra because you've done a good job on both of these. You got a lot of years. Now, at the Sentra, you're going to have a tranny between now at 150, between now and 200,000. But that's about it. For all the air conditioning you've done, the water pumps you've done, the hoses and belts you've done, you're even. I still say keep the Sentra. And that advice is free. Okay?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your honest advice.
Thank you very much, Hector. Jerry, what can we do for you?
I'm just going to make a call back on I called you about a couple months ago about what I thought was a lean, coaling aisle, rough aisle on a big Rainier.
Okay.
And I did numerous checks on the engine and couldn't come up with anything. And it all started when the weather got cooler. But I heard some issues. Maybe the issues in motor mounts, but I thought 70,000 miles, it shouldn't be motor mounts. So, however, I got to checking, and they weren't tore loose or anything, but I noticed that you put it in drive, you had the rough idle. Put it in reverse, it was smooth. And I thought, well, this can't be engine problems. So I took a chance and put a set of engine mounts in it, and it's smooth as silk.
Smooth as a baby's butt.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Well, and let me tell you, I'm very proud of you. I'm very proud of you because the test you ran is exactly what you do. And that's a magnificent thing for me to hear from somebody, because you put it in drive and we're loading the load mount, because one side of the engine has the load and the other side of the engine has the flex.
Yeah.
So by going into drive, we're doing the right front. We're testing the right front. There are vibrations there. The right front's collapsed. You put it in reverse, we're going to lift up off the right front and we're going to hit hard on the left front.
Yeah.
So when we move the motor around by going reverse, neutral, drive, neutral, reverse, neutral, drive, and we move that around and the vibration changes, it's always the mounts. Now, here's the problem. When you go to a lot of shops, they're going to tell you if we do one, we do them all. Did you do them all?
Well, I did both the engine. I didn't do the transmission.
Okay. I would have done just what you did. I would have said, we can fix one and do it, but fixing one is like putting a new shoe on the right foot new shoe. But there is no benefit to taking one mount times four.
Yeah,
because we're in the $1,000, north of $1,000 range, and that really serves the shop.
Yeah.
And there's no duplication of labor. So if I do one mount each time, there is no duplication of labor. Almost always, there's no duplication of labor. So there's no real benefit to you doing, you or anybody else. So I'm proud of you. I think you did a great job in diagnosis. And if you need a job at a light duty shop, call me and I'll send you to somebody.
Well, I'm a retired mechanic. I was a mechanic for 40 years, so I kind of put my expertise into motion there.
And see, you're a gray haired guy. That's what I talk about.
It was a fun job doing that on my driveway out in front of a garage here at 80 years old.
Well, God bless you. I feel bad by saying I'm proud of you, but I'm proud of you for being a mechanic. I'm proud of you using your skills. I'm proud of you fixing your cars using common sense, and you didn't get on the internet and try to YouTube this problem. So thank you very much. Got to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. I want to tell you a story about a guy that started working on cars in 1954 in Arizona. His name's Kelly Clark. Him and Rita are friends of my wife, Renee, and I. Kelly is one of the most, he's kind, he's a giant man, his hands look like tennis rackets. Rita is tougher than Kelly is times 10, but they know the difference between right and wrong, and they do know the automotive business. They're down to their last shop, which is at 12th Street in Glendale. 12th Street in Glendale, they have ASC certified technicians. They can cover virtually every inch of your car, truck, or SUV. They're professional, they're honest, they're reliable, and they have fair prices. They're open Monday through Saturday, 12th Street in Glendale. So if you live in that central Phoenix area, you're looking for a good shop, may I suggest 12th Street in Glendale, Kelly Clark Automotive. I'm going to tell a real quick story. We're on the houseboat with Kelly and Rita, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Rita takes me, not Renee, but she takes me into the bathroom of this houseboat. And she says to me, you will not stand, you will sit.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Call it if I'm telling the
truth. Well, I wasn't in there, but okay. I've heard the story, so okay. I'm assuming.
So the next morning, I wake up, and the only person that's up before me is Rita. She's making coffee, and the kitchen is adjoining the bathroom. So I go into the bathroom, and I take a cup of water, and I lift the toilet seat, and I lift the cup of water about 2 feet above, and I start pouring the cup of water in the toilet. The next thing I know, Rita is going crazy outside the door, going, Mark Salem, you sit down, you sit down. So I open up the bathroom door. She sees me pouring the water in there, and she never let me go for the rest of the trip. She was just out to get me, but she's a wonderful lady. Kelly's a wonderful guy, and together they make a great couple. So when I tell you that he's been around since Jesus was a baby, I'm not BSing you. He has.
Yeah.
All righty, let's go to the phones. I know this family for a long time. Okay. I've known most of my shops for a very long
That's
time,
what
but
I was
I've
gonna say.
I've known Kelly longer than anybody.
Right.
So all right, we're going to go to Alan. Alan, how can I help you?
Good morning, Mark. Just wanted to give you a call back, giving a shout out to Larry Harkers. I don't know if you remember or not, but a couple weeks ago I called on a 2005 FX35, and make a long story short, wasn't running right, was some type of obvious ignition problem, and another shop told me it was low compression and I needed a new motor. And they told me this three times while I tried to debate that we have an ignition problem here, and they just didn't budge off it. So I called you and said, hey, got kind of a problem here, and this is what's going on. I said, would you take your car to Larry Harker to have him fix it? And you said, without hesitation, I would do it. So I went ahead and took it there, and it ended up being a really kind of an oddball problem, but in the end, I think we got it fixed. It was a electrical problem where the grounds weren't grounding right, and it ended up being just had a motor mount issue you were talking about. It was the same thing. The motor mount was stretching the ground wire, interfering with the electrical circuits and overheating the coils, and it fried out two sets of coils on that motor. And he replaced the second set of coils on his dime.
Okay.
So I just wanted to, like I said, wanted to give a shout out to Larry Harker, and thank you again for the recommendation to those guys. They are now on the top of my
recommended shops for the west side. I do a lot of mechanical work on bikes and stuff, and I don't do a lot of car stuff in the driveway,
okay.
So I send them to other shops, and now Larry Harker is the top of where I'm sending people to.
Okay, he's got an electrical problem. He did a volt drop test. He was smart enough to know he's got to do that. So he puts his ground on the ground, and he hits all the positives, and if one of them says positive at 12.8 and this one says 9.6, then this circuit is defective. So I either have a bad ground to that circuit or have a ground back power. Likewise, we put the positive on the positive side of the battery, and we start touching the negative to the engine, the frame, the fenders, the intake manifold, the core support, and every single voltage reading from positive of the battery everywhere we touch the ground better be the same.
Yep.
He clearly found a problem there. That's the first attack. I've told people that that gray-haired son of a gun knows more about cars, and you don't even have to wave the proverbial red flag in front of him. He can fix stuff that makes me hide in the bathroom. So I am proud to...
Well, the interesting thing about this was, it was one of the intermittent things. They fixed it the first time. It ran great for 2 days, and all of a sudden it started missing on one cylinder and then missing on another one. And, you know, it wasn't an obvious issue. And those, especially electrical problems without, you know, obvious fried wires or broken wires, are really hard to track down. So I'm always impressed when someone can locate an electrical issue like that and get it resolved.
Well, what happened is he had bad coils, so he replaced them thinking that's going to take care of it. When you brought back two of his new coils that had gone bad, then he says, okay, I got to start at the fundamentals. I'm telling you, I'm thinking what he's thinking, but frankly, he thinks just different than anybody else. And he just has the fundamental knowledge about cars that few other people have. So that's why I tell people, when you get a problem that nobody else can fix, then you got to go to Harker's. But I got to run, but thank you. And I also going to send him a copy of what you just said, because I'm going to cut it out and send it to him. So he'll know that you're a happy camper. I got to go on. Who's next? Hale. Hale, how are you? What can I do for you?
Mark, I've got a 2000 Chevrolet Corvette with a standard engine. Every time I fuel up, I check the oil. Every time I check the oil, it's about a half a quart low. So I was thinking about adding some, but I didn't. I let it sit overnight, checked it overnight, and the oil's at the full mark. So here's my question. When you fuel up, when do you decide to add oil?
Only when it's below the add mark. Only.
But can you do that when you're out on the road, when you're going to San Diego or something? Should you check it? I guess I don't wait long enough for the oil to drain down.
That's exactly what you're suggesting. The evidence that you're setting on my plate in front of me is just exactly that. But when you say it's a half a quart down, are you talking about a half a quart off the full or a half a quart below the add?
Half a quart off full.
No, you never. When you see that oil between half add and full, forget it. Don't worry about it after that. I'm only concerned when you pull the stick and it's below the add mark. Because, see, that's something that people, they fool me with. That's the reason why I've learned to ask you, half a quart off full? Because, see, half a quart off full is halfway between add and full, because add and full is a quart. So you're saying you're a half a quart off full. You're right. There is a drain back issue. But we call it the static level. So if you're a quart low, then you're going to be a half a quart below the add, and if you let it sit, you'll come back up to the add. But when you pull the stick and it's below the add mark, then you're due for a quart. But I can tell you, you could drive that Corvette under normal conditions with a hot cup of coffee between your legs. You could drive that Corvette to San Diego at the add mark and be fine. But if you're going to drive like an idiot and have that coffee cup all over your lap, then that would be kind of an iffy. But you could drive to California with no problem. Thank you, Hale. That was a great question. Thank you.
I wondered what the coffee had to do with.
Well, it describes how you drive.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing that up, because probably some other people missed that too as well.
Yeah, well, then you kind of cleared it up, but at first I thought you were going in a different direction, which you do many times.
I do.
When I'm talking to you, it's like, wait, we changed subject.
You know, the hard part is with radio, they can't see my hands. You know how I wave my hands?
If you sat on them, you couldn't do
I couldn't
this
talk.
Show. Yeah, you couldn't do this show.
I did get a nice letter.
Okay.
Okay. Mark, please accept our heartfelt thanks for looking at my husband's 81 El Camino. I called you for a recommendation on the show, and I said to the lady, I would like to look at it myself. She was one of those that nobody can fix this. Mm-hmm. So I would like to look at it. I told her that there was a shop close by mine mm-hmm. that I would refer to if it happened to be a computer programming. We did look at it. We didn't charge her. Mm-hmm. We did take it down there. They yes. did fix it. I think the bill was $2,600. They had to remap the computer. They had to tell the computer that this was an 81 El Camino with this motor, this fuel injection.
That's what I was going to say. It was a bunch of different years, and it was very confusing.
It was like having six versions of Windows in your computer.
Right.
So they repaired it. They were very thorough, and the 81 is running beautifully. We want to tell you how grateful we are for Salem Boys looking at our El Camino and then referring it to the right shop. Mm-hmm. That's what we're all about.
Right.
We don't, folks, don't let it escape you that I don't talk about my shop other than in generic terms. This show isn't about me or my shop. This show is about our industry. And what I try to do is talk about how we're supposed to act, and then when you tell me that this is what happened, then through your eyes, I'm going to take that as being valid, and at this point, then I'm going to tell you that that's really not what industry standards are all about. Few people have the expertise in industry standards that I do. If you're a lawyer, you understand that I've been certified in Superior Court for the state of Arizona to testify about industry standards. I'm also an expert in the auto mechanic industry, and I'm an ASE Master Certified Technician. So I am also qualified in court to testify as to that. So the whole purpose of this show is to bring a friendly nature to our industry, to refer you to shops that I have thoroughly vetted.
Yeah.
There's nobody on my list that's going to take advantage of you. Nobody. And it's just like that gentleman said a few minutes ago that they told him about that. It's, one of them said that he needs an engine.
Yeah.
And he has dead cylinders and engine. His cost of paying that bogus bill. Mm-hmm. And here's the bad news. The bad news is they probably would have fixed the ground when they replaced the motor, because the ground goes from the frame to the motor.
Right.
And so as that motor was moving around, that ground was changing. So when they took the motor out and put it back in, mm-hmm. there's a good chance that that would have fixed it. But that's not what he needed.
Right.
So the second opinion is something I want to drive home to you. I want you to know that when you get the engine, then I need you to get a second opinion. I'll tell you a quick story.
Oh, I was going to say even, you know, less, maybe $1,000 or whatever you're comfortable with. Always get a second opinion, because we find a lot of people have been told something and then you go in and it's a minor problem a lot of times.
We, talking about our shops, because
right.
they tell us the same thing. They'll
right.
call us and they'll say, hey, Mark, hey, Renee, this is what happened. This is what they came in. This worked out. A guy took his differential into a shop that I'd never heard of before, mm-hmm. and he said he had an oil leak in the differential. It needed a front pinion seal. They did the pinion seal. Shortly thereafter, he had a noise, and he described it this way. Every time the rear wheels were turning, I had a noise. Mm-hmm. Then he took it back, and they said, oh, the whole rear end's gone bad. We told you that that might happen. So they did $900-some-odd worth of work to it. They gave it back to him. He had exactly the same noise. It didn't change, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And they told him they had put new gears in it. This differential came to us. We opened it up and found out clearly there's not new parts in this. Mm-hmm. There was one or two, but there wasn't seven or eight.
Right.
We also found that the pinion had been torqued to well past 150 pounds of torque, and it really should have been at 20 pounds of torque. They had pulled so hard on the pinion that they had wiped out the ring and pinion, and the ring and pinion were not new like they represented. Mm-hmm. I think the bill at our place was $23, $24, $100,
yeah.
$25, $26, mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. We had to replace the ring and pinion, all the bearings, all the seals, everything. The only thing we didn't do is the axle bearings. We gave it back to him. We said, drive it. If we didn't fix it, just keep on driving. Don't even come back.
Mm-hmm.
So we fixed it, and then he went to the shop, and they said to him, well, you didn't let us have a chance to fix it. And he said, you had two chances. He says, I went in for an oil leak. You gave me a noise. You charged me to fix it the first time. You charged me to fix it the second time. And you think I'm going to bring it back for the third time?
Mm-hmm.
So they have just avoided that. Here's the bad news. The bad news is now he's turned it over to his insurance company. Now his insurance company is going to go after the shop because truthfully, the shop damaged his car.
Right.
The shop damaged his car, and the proof is in the parts that we gave him back. He has all the old parts.
Yeah.
So now the insurance company is going to put him back whole, and they're going to probably pay our bill. Then they're going to sue the shop for the money, and that shop will go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, that's one of the shops that should have gone out of business when this happens. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that my life fills up with. And there's other good things. You know, yeah. I have horses and cows, and then I have my family and my kids who drive me crazy, but not nearly as bad as my wife.
Yeah, that's right. So they can go to Best Car Repair Shops at marksalem.com and find good shops that we recommend, and we have for a long time, since 1988. So.
And also, here's my promise. If a shop doesn't perform as the Better Business Bureau tells them to, and they're supposed to give you money or fix your car, and they don't, I will up to $5,000. That's written on our website. $5,000. I got you covered if they don't provide. I'll see you next week.